All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Free For All right here, as usual, back to our normal time slot, Hody, here on Thursday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern. Glad we could be here for everyone on Grumblings Media. Look us up, grumblingsmedia.com. Also, hit up all your favorite streaming platforms on social media, YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, X, and just search for at Grumblings Media, all one word. You'll find us, Free For All, and a lot more. We have other stuff here too, Hody. But for right now, let's get started. Let me introduce myself. I am your host, Big John, and joined this evening, as we are wont to do, by my good friend and co-host, Mr. Hody Johns. Hodester, how you doing today?
I'm all mirrored. I started pointing the wrong direction. I apparently flipped around, but I am actually doing it. Yeah, right. That way I can't ever be wrong. Just point both directions.
Exactly.
Have you seen that clip where Usher thought he was going to be edited into the middle of like a Hollywood
I thought that was hilarious. That's a Jimmy Fallon thing, right? Yeah, he was supposed to be in the middle. And he's Yeah. Maybe we'll get that one day. But yeah, that's absolutely right. So Hody, how you doing this week? How you feeling, man?
Yeah, really good. I let things kind of get away from me last week as far as just I have a blessed life in the sense that I have everything that I do is 10 out of 10 fun. And unfortunately, there's not enough time for me to fit all the 10 out of 10 fun things in there. So anything that I let go of is either like a 9 out of 10 fun or a 10 out of 10 fun. And I just don't have enough space for it. So, you know, last week I got a little overwhelmed with it. I caught up with it all and then some this week. So I'm back on top of it. And I feel very good whenever I'm on top of the world. So, yeah, I'm doing very well. Yeah, and very excited about this because I like talking about economics so long as it doesn't affect me personally. And I'm sure many people can relate to me in that regard.
To paraphrase Uncle Milton Friedman, you love to talk about other people's money, but never so much and so close as you talk about your own. Okay, first of all, let's point this out because I think it bears a little bit of a notice. Check out the digs around us, our new libertarian-themed studio background here, Hody. What do you think? What do you like about it? You like the subtle message of using gold as a stable currency, stable StreamYard background?
I mean, this way I stop having to tell people we're number one. I just show them the gold. They know where that goes on the podium, and that's it. You know, it's that simple.
I did not take it from the Olympic perspective. Thank you for bringing that to my attention, Mr. Hody. All right, everyone. Big John, along with Hody Johns here. And Hody alluded to it. We are going to talk a little bit of economics today, economic policy, trade, a lot of things that have been in the news for the past week. So certainly, if you're out there listening or watching us, please feel free to jump in the chat. Send us your questions, comments. Tell us you love us. Tell us you hate us. We're open to discussion, so please feel free. That's on X, Rumble, Facebook, and YouTube. Feel free to hop in the chat and just hit us up with your questions. We'll be happy to involve folks. That's what we're here for. All right, Hody, the first thing on, I guess, everyone's mind was the news earlier this week that the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis released a report April 30th, to be exact, so that would be yesterday morning, that the U.S. Gross GDP had contracted by 0.3%. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but there's a couple of things we need, and I'll set the table for you because I want you to get your economic chops in here as well, right? So, people say, 1/3 of 1%? We contracted 1/3 of 1%? We shrunk by 1/3 of 1%? How bad could that be? How bad is it? What are we talking about, 1/3 of a percent? So let's put it in context. I'll try my best to put it in context. First of all, a contraction means that the overall economy, think of it as just production, decreased by 1/3. Why is that important? Well, there's two reasons why that's important. From a technical perspective, it means this is the first quarter towards two, so we're halfway there, of being in a recession. So a technical recession is two consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. That's what economists, that's what most analysts would say. You're at the throes of a recession. Now, to be fair, that's just the technical definition. It could be a mild recession, which by the third quarter you're out of already. It could be the beginning of a steeper recession where things start to really, people really feel the hurt. And in the worst case scenario, once you're in the middle of a recession, you make dumber moves, and that throws you into the throes of a depression, which is what happened in 1929. So that's the first thing why it's important to consider that, hey, as our good friend Mike Termott, the good old Austrian economist, told me on Liberty Lens yesterday, that's step one. We're in step one of the recession, so keep that in mind. The second reason it's important is, and this is where I see a lot of conservative commentators make a mistake. They say it's only one third of a contraction. Geez Louise, it's nothing. Don't be panitarians or panicans. Is that the MAGA phrase for people who pay attention?
Panican, yeah.
Panicans, footy. And they'll say, don't be a panican. It's only a third of a percent. What's misleading about that is it's not like there's a quarter over quarter change of one third of 1%. It's actually a change of negative 2.7%, because in the fourth quarter of last year, which is the previous quarter, which was Biden's last quarter in office, the economy grew at 2.4%. So when you put it all together, if we went from positive 2.4% expansion of the economy to negative 0.3 contraction or 0.3 contraction, that's a total difference of 2.7%, and that is significant. It's not an insignificant number. So that's where I think I've noticed a lot of people who are saying, don't panic, don't be Chicken Little and whatnot. They're just quoting the negative 0.3, but they're not looking at the quarter-over-quarter delta. So if you were to see it on a graph, it's not a small blip. It's a noticeable blip down. Hody, I've set the table. What do you have to say about this?
Yeah, you know, for anybody who's kind of confused about this, whenever they see numbers and they're like, apparently that's really bad, really good, I like to boil it down to household income, like just imagine this is your situation, right? So imagine that, you know, your total value of your home is $200,000. You owe $230,000 against the house, right? So we owe, unfortunately, our national debt is greater than our total gross domestic product. We could mortgage literally everything we have, and we would not be able to pay all our debts. So you think, well, why isn't the U.S. just underwater right now? Well, simply, we mortgage this against our children. So we believe that we will expand enough now so that our children can pay it back later. You know, that we're going to take a little out of their piggy banks, maybe even a lot out of their piggy banks, as the case may be, in the hopes that they can pay us back for some of the stuff that we're setting up now. If right. I'm to steel man the Keynesian point, the idea is that what we're investing in now, you know, like businesses will oftentimes, McDonald's will go into debt to open a new location because they know it's going to be profitable right away. Believe it or not, our politicians and cops have not been exactly hammer on the nail as far as investments goes and getting that money back right away. So the disaster when you're not making enough money, when we phrase everything like that, is just be like, hey, listen, our interest on the debt in the United States is going to be $1 trillion a year, you know, in 1 year. So let's say just this year on your home, Big John, assuming that we've got the home analogy set up here. Listen, hey, I know you're underwater in your house, but I absolutely need $30,000 from you this year. Now you're like, all right, you know what? I'm going to nose to the grindstone. I'm going to work hard. And quarter one, your total household, the money that you brought in is negative $300. Now, negative $300 isn't an awful lot, but you need to come up with $30,000 by the end of the year. So starting off with negative, you know, 0.3%, you know, in the hole is a disaster. Like, this would be really bad news if it was 1%. This would be really bad news if it was, let's say, half of the last quarter, 1%.
Or even flat.
Or flat. Zero. Right. I sat at home and I ordered Little Caesars and ended up making no money. $0 is what I have to get back to the bank. And so it makes, now, long term, this would make the country insolvent. The idea is when something like this happens, you have to make a change. Most of those times, those changes are unpleasant. And so it's something that we said, boy, we took out this big loan, and not only did we not knock it out of the park, we're actually shrinking. It was actually a negative investments that we're making here.
Right.
So that's kind of the way to think about it for me when I try to break this down to people. Obviously, it's a little more complex than just like credit card debt mortgages, but yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of different intricate levers here, right? So in addition to the contraction of GDP, which to your point, when you think of it as if you were to personify, you're making less money right now, okay? You're working just as hard, but you're making less money. Your bills are exactly the same. Your credit, you don't even have to make a mortgage out of it. Your credit card bill. If I put $3,000 a month on my credit bill, I'm okay as long as I'm bringing in $4,000 a month. If I only bring in $3,000 a month, now I'm a little bit in trouble. If I only bring in $2,000, now I'm really in trouble, right? Because now that credit card bill has interest added and it just keeps going. And that's a situation many Americans find themselves in. But in addition to the contraction of the economy, the GDP contraction, we also had an increase in inflation. So predictably, with the president's trade policies, which include tariffs and include this part of the deal stuff that he claims to be doing, inflation, which the Fed had targeted at 2%, actually came in at 3.2 or 3.4, but it was over 3%. Now, that's not an overwhelmingly crushing annualized inflation rate. Honestly, right? Like most countries, like if you look at a lot of Latin American countries or European, or third world countries, they would literally kill for a 3% inflation rate. They're used to double digit inflation, triple digit inflation, right? But for the U.S., again, because of our debt issues, that inflation rate becomes an issue. Now, when you have Hody and the reason we start out with this contraction is because it sets the stage for everything else that happens, right? So right now, we had this contraction. And when you combine it with the inflation, so now you're seeing things hit the pockets of people. I know there's a lot of administration talking points where they'll say gas is down, the price of gas is down, the price of a dozen eggs is down. They always give you different numbers and they're always wrong, right? The wholesale price of eggs is down 50%. The retail price of eggs has actually gone up a couple of points. You won't see that relief from the wholesale eggs until like another couple of weeks. So give them credit, and I'll allow them their usual, we can't do math, so they got that part wrong. But a lot of people I know are buying this line, like, hey, eggs are cheaper, gas is cheaper. Yeah, but everything else is going up. Durable goods are going up, you know, so a lot of these things. So when you have this contraction, you have inflation, which has now been – you know, it's up. It's math. That's not a Democrat point of view. It's not a liberal point of view. It's not a conservative point of view. It's just numbers. Inflation is up, and it's above the Fed target rate. And we're going to jumble up all our issues here, Hody, so you're going to have to try to keep pace with me. I apologize for my ADD, but do your best, man. Do your best.
You got it. Okay. I'm ready to scroll up and down on our notes.
What is the number one way that government battles inflation? What government lever do we use to battle inflation, traditionally speaking? I know the libertarian answer is stop spending.
Stop printing out money, right?
Like, stop printing out money.
Yeah.
But we don't have a libertarian government. So given the hand we're dealt, how is inflation battled?
Allowing gross domestic product to catch up with currency. You know what?
Like I said, you're thinking like a libertarian.
So
it's that interest rates go up, right? So the Fed will raise interest rates to constrict the money supply, right? And that's supposed to battle inflation. So part of this is also now, what's President Trump's mantra when it comes to interest rates?
They got to go down.
They got to go down to zero, like in his first term, because that spurs, theoretically, investment. Money is cheap to borrow, so it literally pays to borrow money at 0.1% or 2% or whatever to be able to then invest in, you know, use capital investment and you grow, right? Well, Mr. Powell over at the Fed says, mm-mm, our target for inflation is 2%. And if we're running at 3.2, 3.4, I can't lower those rates. That'll just jack up inflation even more. And what does that do to President Trump? He wants to get rid of the Fed chairman, which I don't know if he can do in the middle of his term. I think that's a point of contention that a lot of people are like, you can't get rid of it. And as Mike Tremont has pointed out to me several times, as libertarians, we want to end the Fed. But until we get to Ancapistan, until we get to our anarchist utopia, Odie, we got to play with the hand that's dealt. There is a Fed. One of the things that makes our Fed probably the best central bank in the world is its independence or its relative independence compared to the political game going on in D.C., right? Relative. Like, so if you go to Bank of England or anywhere else, very tied into the politics. So Powell is like, as long as I'm the Fed chair, these rates are not coming down until I see inflation, until we bring that inflation rate down. That's one of our dual mandates, right? So now you have the political tension that's set up between the Trump administration and the Fed. So Hody, what's your thoughts on this? Like, it seems to me like the president has painted himself into a corner policy-wise, right? He'll want to deal with, I need interest rates down, but we're getting screwed on trade. The president says this at every opportunity. We've been ripped off on trade. The rest of the world is ripping us off. We're losers. We need to set the table straight. So, Hody, tell me, what kind of sense are you getting from the economic policies of the president? Do you feel that he has an actual plan? Do you feel that his advisors have an actual plan? Or, and this is where I'll let you talk, I promise I'll shut up, Hody, is this more about American hegemony? Is it more about making sure that America is number one, if at least in the Western world, if not the world, as opposed to sound economic policy? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, you said it. Of course, as libertarians, we want to end the Fed. Listen, I kind of cringe a little anytime the Fed is brought up as like, well, it's independent. It's not technically government. It exists, literally was created by a government edict. It is established and its employees are government stooges. And frequently, I mean, we have seen, I think every year of my life, the politicians can just sign a law and command the Fed to do something. So it's like, oh yeah, they're totally independent. Hey guys, print off $50,000. Like, you know, it's just that's like me saying my neighbor's independent when I have a gigantic tank pointed at him. And I'm like, all right, give me another $700. Hey, he's not related to me at all. He's doing his own thing over there, right?
Like, but they're independent in the sense that they can't be, they haven't been replaced, meaning the Fed chairman hasn't been replaced in the middle of a sitting term. Yes, the president can get rid of him when his term is up and put in his political hack, but generally speaking, and then each local Fed can also set its own policy, right? So, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect, and in no way am I insinuating, Hody, that they're these paragons of impartiality, but I'm saying, especially comparatively to the rest of the world, our Fed is fairly independent as opposed to the rest of the world, central banks around the world.
I'll recommend a book for anybody curious about this. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. It is very good detail-oriented book about kind of how the Fed was conceived and the evils that it was conceived to do and the evils that it has done. As libertarians, obviously, no shortage on ammunition there. I do want to say you are correct that what's good about it, when it is actually good, is when it actually is independent, when it actually does get to, well, I wouldn't say it's even then it's good, but the more independent it is, the less connected it is to politicians, the better. So when Donald Trump wants to be like, hey, guys, set the interest rate at this, and they say no, we should be like, okay, that's because they're trying to fight inflation. That's a good thing, right? Anybody who's able to say no to politicians, we libertarians, we love that, right? So they need to be able to say no because they're trying to keep things afloat, right? When somebody like Donald Trump is like, how dare you say no? Yes, of course they can pass laws to force them to do things. We have done this, like I said, every year of my life that I have been alive, they have signed a law to force the Fed to do something. They could sign a law to force their interest rate to be whatever they want it to be at. but this is always bad. Right? This is always bad when we have, you know, some people that are trying to keep things fiscally responsible, and the politicians are like, hey, we need you to force you to do something that's not fiscally responsible. So you're correct in this identifier here, that this is a step towards the other nations who have it worse than us, that have a Fed that's more political, that's more controlled. As soon as we open up the door to them to say, oh, sure, the now politicians can just tell them what the interest rate to set it at, you know, and then it's like, okay, yeah. Well, where now they've lost any ability to control the economy at all. They're forced to print money every year. They're forced to adjust the, you know, prime rate. They're forced to, you know, and now they don't even exist to at least try to provide some pushback against the government to try and, like, keep our money solvent. And so right. this it's like separation of church and state. The more that it's blended, the worse things are for both the church and the state. The right. more politicians get a hold of a printing press with money, the worse it is for everybody.
Yeah, and the thing, I agree with everything you said. And what's happening here is, I think that, and I know it's hack to say we're being gaslit. I understand that. And I'm trying to avoid using that phrase. But what's happening here is you have, like, there's this new media that is very much, it's the... Again, I'm struggling with words because I don't want to say anything that's totally – I don't want to say woke right, but if I were to say woke right, you might understand what I'm trying to say, which is the old mainstream media has now been replaced by the social media mainstream media, which is you have all the right-wing influencers. They've now been given a seat at the press conferences, so you have your Tim Pools, your DC Drainos, like all the Trump sycophants in there. And it is literally a repeat of the left-wing media that supported left-wing administrations. Now, there are plenty of people who will say, good, turnabout's fair play, fight fire with fire, whatever one of these old adages you want. Hody, I'm one of those people that believes you don't justify bad behavior by simply citing that you're doing the same thing as the person you allegedly despise in this world. I think when you get to that point, you've lost the battle, right? So if you say, I've got a sycophantic media supporting this administration that's unwilling to challenge the administration, if I point it out to you and you say, well, why is that any different than what CNN did with Biden? Didn't they hide his incompetency? Didn't they hide his dementia for all this time? Yes, and that was horrible. And we all spent a lot of time complaining about it. So why would you seek to replace that with your version of that, right? So I hate it when someone says, well, CNN's the same thing. Yeah, make yourself better than CNN. Make yourself better than the people that you despise. Not that I despise anybody, but make yourselves better than what you, the behavior that you're railing against. So part of it is that a lot of these folks that have been brought in, when you combine it with the blind loyalty that a lot of the administration has for President Trump. Remember, it's not competency that was sought after in this administration. It was loyalty. So you have all this, and no one's stepping up to say, well, what did you expect would happen? And why did we think it would be okay when we're pursuing these policies, right? Lately, the president has been on a little bit of a press tour, and his number one phrase is, we've been ripped off all this time. And you guys voted for me because I read The Art of the Deal, which was, by the way, ghostwritten by somebody else and then later admitted was like 80% BS. Trump never did half the stuff in that book. It was like, so anybody who quotes The Art of the Deal, you're quoting fiction, by the way. That none of that stuff happened for the most part. So anyway, so he's, that's why you picked me. Let's make great deals. We've been getting ripped off. And it becomes more and more apparent that the president is interested in pushing this agenda that the U.S. has been taken advantage of, that the U.S. is on the brink of economic collapse because of dirty old China or the rest of the world ganging up on us. And, Hody, the thing to keep in mind here is, first of all, as libertarians, we believe any voluntary trade, there are no winners and losers. In any voluntary exchange, both sides come out ahead because they each got what they wanted because nobody put a gun to their head to make that deal, right? Like if you're selling apples and I give you a dollar for one of your apples, Hody, you're happy because you got a dollar that you didn't have. And I'm happy because I get a delicious apple that I didn't previously have. That is a fundamental concept of free market, of capitalism, of volunteerism, any one of these wonderful words you want to use, right? So the president, however, cannot wrap his head around that. He views that every deal, every trade, every exchange, there's a winner and there's a loser. It's a zero-sum game. I can't win and you can't win. In his mind, the way that you know this is because we have trade deficits with certain nations. We buy more from them than they buy from us. And you get this, like, and it's this most childish of economic outlooks, in my opinion. It is literally, you never got to the second day of your economics class, of Econ 101. You never got to it. If that's your whole outlook. Now, unfortunately, what's happening is there's a lot of people buying into this nonsense where it's like, we can't, you know, you give them the old example, whether it came from Thomas Sowell or Milton Friedman or Adam Smith even, right? Where you say, like, okay, go to your grocery store, right? Hody, if you're a writer, say, you go to the grocery store, you buy your groceries every week. Have they ever once paid you for writing services?
No, darn it.
No.
You have a massive deficit with Home Depot right now, by the way.
Right, you have a massive deficit with Home Depot. They are ripping you off, man, because you keep buying from them and they've never asked you to write something for them. Well, guess what? You're not upset at Home Depot because you went and you got it what you needed from Home Depot. Home Depot is running probably a trade deficit with its suppliers. They spend a lot with their suppliers, and the suppliers don't spend anything with them. A trade deficit in and of itself is not indicative of you being ripped off or of you winning. It just shows you market efficiencies. We're better at exporting stuff right now. We're a service economy. We're no longer a manufacturing economy. We're no longer an industrial economy. And guess what? That's a good thing because it's not 1936 anymore. So the concept you're describing is
zero-sum economy. To anybody who looks this up, Big John, and I think this may be something that you agree with, I think it's an absolute travesty that most high schools don't even offer economics courses.
Agreed.
That this is something that is oftentimes an elective and oftentimes waits until college for people to take it if they take it at all. And it's really a shame. I mean, this is and to be clear, another book I'm going to recommend.
You always have a book or two there, Hody.
Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell is a fantastic book, and it really is one of those that is going to hammer home the idea that you could talk about economics through pure illustrations. Like, this is really, to understand economy, you don't need a big brain. We've made it a big brain subject, but that is just like social stigma. It is something that you could do a children's book about, and they would understand how zero-sum economy is stupid. They might not describe it as zero-sum economy because those kind of sound like big words, but it would immediately, upon hearing stuff like this, they would rule that out. They would be like, oh, that's economic illiteracy. That's not the way things work in this world. The thing is like you said, day two of Economics 101, you have to abandon this. And it's very striking to anybody who's taking these courses. I'll give you another example, but just with my degree in theology. Anybody who doesn't think that the Garden of Eden is a biblical allegory, and I went to extremely Christian conservative college, Liberty University, you won't make it one day. You know, you will have to intentionally like fall asleep during the part where they talk about the Near East religions, right? And that time period. And so there's just no getting out of it, you know, that the Garden of Eden was an allegory. It's not something that even the rabbis of that time period, when the Bible was written, argued, right? Like that it was like, oh no, it's 6 days for sure, guys, right? Like this is how it goes. And so, you know, and I went into it believing the earth was, you know, created in 7 days, sure.
Right.
But it's one of those, as soon as you get that education, and even when you look into it yourself, you're like, oh, nobody believes that, right? Like anybody with any amount of intellect in this matter doesn't get to day two and still hold on to that belief. And this is very true economically, just to relate it to, if you embrace that zero-sum politics, as soon as you believe that Home Depot's ripping you off because you paid, you know, $300 for a smoker and they haven't paid you anything. Like you said, I'm getting what they want. They're getting what they want. I'm getting what I want. I want the smoker. They want the $300. We trade. Now I smoke meats. They have another $300, right?
Right.
I get my money back from somewhere else. You know, and that's always been, and unfortunately not understanding that, to bring this back to kind of the central theme of this conversation, to not understand that is to really not understand why America is the wealthiest country in the world. So it's particularly stupid. It would be dumb if you were like Italian and believe this, but like
why
as an American, well, no, because as an Italian, you're kind of dealing with a simpler economy, right? Like this.
No, I'm joking. I don't know why you picked Italy in particular, but okay, fair enough.
I just felt like it. You know,
Shout out to our Italian homies. We're not picking on you. It's just the first thing that came to Hody's mind for some reason.
It came to my mind because recently they were the fifth biggest economy in the world, and I was actually watching a YouTube video about how like they got passed up and everything. That's just why it comes to my head.
Well, what's interesting, since you mentioned it, that is another perception that the Trump administration is working very hard to put out there, that somehow we're on the brink of collapse. Folks, the top five economies in this world by GDP, and I have the number here somewhere because I want to be super accurate, right? The top five – let me reach over here. I'm getting old, Hody. I can't see that far. The top five economies in the world are, in order of nominal GDP, the United States, China, Germany, India, and Japan right now. This is as of the IMF World Economic Outlook, April 2025. So this is the freshest data, right? Now, you might say, okay, we're number one, but China must be nipping on our heels. To give you sort of a sense of things, the United States is by far the biggest and most powerful economy on the planet, such that if you added up the nominal GDPs of China, Germany, India, and Japan, the next four on that list, the four combined equal the United States. So the United States is number one. They're number one by a lot. So the one thing, if you're a MAGA person, the one thing you should be crowing about is we're number one by far. It's not even close. The nominal GDP for the U.S., $30.5 trillion with a T. China's number two on that list at $19 trillion. So, you know, two-thirds of our economy. And then Germany, India, and Japan. So, and they're all between $4.5 and $5 trillion. So what I'm trying to get at is nobody's nipping at our heels. Nobody is ripping us off. And when you hear the president say we're being put upon, we're being cheated, this and that, and we got to set Vietnam straight when they trade with us. We got to set Singapore straight when they trade with us. Those people are like a flea on the butt of an elephant. For the United States to try to rectify the grievances that the president feels we have suffered at the hands of Singapore or the European Union is laughable. First of all, it's laughable for the reason that we stated, voluntary trade, there are no winners and losers, right? Secondly, a trade deficit does not mean you're getting ripped off. And third, let's assume you are getting ripped off. Who are you getting ripped off by and by how much? To the point where you're the big bully now? Seriously, it'd be like if you and I found like a 10-year-old who stole like a dollar out of my pocket, and then I decide the appropriate punishment is to hold him by the throat, turn him upside down, and shake loose whatever change the kid has in his pockets. Like, right. Really, this
and,
is...
And then you find out that kid's dad was paying you $200 a month, you know?
Yeah, that too, right?
Like, oh, shit.
Yeah, right. So, to me, it's this perception. And Hody, you know, on X, I am not always the reasonable person I am on Free For All. But this past week, as people would hit me up and say, well, we got to hit Canada because they've been hitting us and we got to do to them what they do to us. And I would have to explain to them, who pays the tariffs? Well, we do. No. when Canada puts a tariff on U.S. goods, their citizens pay. And there were actually a few people that when I started to just be reasonable with them, they would say, then why is the president putting tariffs on them if the tariffs hurt us? I would say, yeah, good question. Why is that? Especially with Canada and Mexico. Why would you not have a free trade zone, especially if you're the U.S., right? And what's Murray Rothbard's line? Where goods and services cross borders, armies do not. Why would you now pick a trade war? Picking a trade war for no good reason is, in some ways, an act of war. And it escalates everything else that otherwise might be smoothed away by diplomacy, right? It is, in fact, mercantilism, which is what the president is enamored with. He is enamored with an economic system that went out of style in the 17th century. Mercantilism, Hody, was when the British Empire ran the seaways because that was the way you transported goods, and that's how you kept your gold and your silver. And if anybody got in the way of that, you sent your army and your navy after them, and because you had to keep what's yours and you couldn't share it. President Trump is living in the 17th century. He views mercantilism as a really good economic policy, an economic construct. Who was the first guy who said that's rubbish? Adam Smith. Adam Smith was the first one who said, no. The wealth in a no, let's trade with everybody. Let's trade with everybody. It is one of those concepts that properly and correctly died a long time ago, Hody. For some reason, the president thinks this is 1650 and we got to run the world, we got to run our economy the way the British Empire did. It seems to me that fundamentally he just doesn't understand what free trade and capitalism is about. So now that you have that context, the economy contracts. We're at the beginning maybe of a technical recession, maybe. But his policies, if you've noticed, it's not even like he's very consistent with it. Supposedly, now his apologists will say, they were always negotiating tactics. No, they were stupid policies. And when he saw the beginnings of what was happening, he would pull back, right? He announces these tariffs, markets tank, the bond market goes in the toilet. A big whale in Japan started dumping U.S. treasuries. Guess what? We're going to pull back a little bit. Maybe we'll cap everything at 10%. Even if you did, like Australia famously didn't have any tariffs on U.S. goods, 0% tariffs. But because of that, because the Trump administration used the wrong formula and then on top of that used wrong math in their wrong formula, Australia, who had zero tariffs on us, is now getting hit with a 10% tariff because of that stupid formula. So it has nothing to do with fairness. It has nothing to do with reciprocal tariffs. It has to do with the president thinking that for some reason the road to prosperity in this country goes through manufacturing plants, that we got to bring manufacturing plants. So, Hody, tell me, from what you were able to tell, what's been the effect on consumer spending? And what's been the effect on retail spending? What's been going on tangibly? Forget the economic theory. What's been going on tangibly?
Well, I do want to say, I mean, before we move on from this entirely, to go on what you're saying here, this really is Marxism and communism. Like, it is funny how the right has embraced this. And you might say, this isn't communism. What is communism?
Central planning.
Communism is an idea that every nation or group of people is supposed to be self-sufficient, right? That's the commune, right? So unlike with globalists, free trade, right? Everybody trading with everybody, that every individual commune should be able to have, they sustain their own steel, they grow their own food, they get whatever, and anything extra they can give out maybe, right? Like to somebody else. Now I got bad news for you. In communism, there wasn't a lot extra. Spoiler alert for your history books, kids.
Right.
But you know, that was the idea, is that like you were supposed to be self-sufficient. And so trying to make it so that America doesn't rely on other nations is literally communism. Like Marx would be cheering this strategy. And I am not kidding. Like, if you think like, oh, come on, that's an exaggeration. Really, read anything by Marx, read anything by Hoppe, and you would swear they like plagiarized each other. And you would look at this administration and be like, I think these guys were like way too inspired by Karl Marx. I don't even want to say I die on this hill. This is a challenge to anybody out there who's like, no, it's not. We'll read through some Marx together. And by the end of it, you'll be like, oh. Yeah, this is what he wanted.
Yeah, right? I tried to sell Mike Termont that this is Marxism. I tried really hard with Mike.
Didn't like it, huh? Okay.
He didn't appreciate it because he said, I get what you're trying to do with the central planning aspect of it, that the best way to run an economy is through Washington, which is what President Trump is trying to do right now. So to the extent that it's central planning, you might make a connection to Marxism. But it really is, because he's not looking to take over the means of production or anything, but it's more mercantilistic, it really is, because when you look at it, he wants to have his industries here in the U.S. He does believe that every trade has to end up with a surplus for the U.S. He doesn't believe in everybody winning. He believes we should win. And then our trade should place us at the top of the table when it comes to world politics and world decisions for everybody. As libertarians, I can't think of a reason why a libertarian would support any of the president's policies. A neocon would, a mercantilist would, and then MMT theorist would. But the problem with that, all that is, it's like the basic stuff. While he's doing this nationalistic stuff with the, like, number one, we're going to screw everybody, and they've been screwing us, we'll screw them. What you're forgetting is his spending has gone up. Forget about the Doge thing. That hasn't worked. As much as Elon Musk now has to go run Tesla because they're going to kick him off his board, much like I predicted, what's happening now is the actual realized savings of everything that he's done is, it's not even a rounding error, right? It's so insignificant as to not be worth mentioning. And because they had the continuing resolution of the Biden budget, they've actually increased government spending. Now, there have been reductions in government jobs, which good for them, but that only accounted for like 0.2%, 0.25% of that entire 2.7 decline quarter over quarter. So far, not nearly enough. So while people are cheering on him, like he'll show those darn Chinese. Meanwhile, while you've been cheering that on, he's increased spending. He's increased inflation. So what are we talking about? Because he has a supposed deal to have some foreign manufacturers come here and open up a plant somewhere in the middle of nowhere for 1,200 manufacturing jobs. That, by the way, there's more manufacturing vacancies in terms of jobs in this country than there are people ready to fill them, which nobody seems to mention either, right? Yay, another plant. Well, who's going to go work there? Whose children are you sending to college to go work in a manufacturing plant in this country, which – fair or not, let's face it, it is what it is. The market has already set this. The market has figured out how much industrial work needs to stay in this country. Nobody in Washington needs to figure it out. And if you're a libertarian that somehow supports this nonsense, you're not. I got news for you. You're not a libertarian. Again, I know we're using that old libertarian litmus test, and it goes against your nature there, Hody. But this is so unlibertarian in the way that the Trump administration seeks to make itself the arbiter of the economy. It's not a matter of adding or subtracting regulations. You want to eliminate regulations? Great. You want to fire some unnecessary jobs in Washington? Great. Shrink the size of – we're all for that. But why we're allowing the president to decide that a trade deficit is bad, why we're allowing the president to affect – the free market's direction and allocation of its capital is beyond me. Hody, we're seeing real-world examples of this. Small businesses are super increased their imports because they said, we got to buy our durable goods before these tariffs hit. Yep. Before this 145% tariff hits, I got to stock up on my lumber, on my textile, all the other stuff I get from everywhere else except the U.S. that I get at a good price. Because I gotta hoard it. Well, you might say to yourself, well, good for them. They're hoarding, and that'll teach them to buy American. Okay, let's say you're a nationalist. Fine. You're a neocon. Great. You're a Republican or a Democrat. Great. That's a proper economic position. But if you're a libertarian, why would you be interested in that? Why are we allowing the government, Hody, to distort market forces? Who would cheer such a thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not libertarian. We can argue about it. I mean, it's definitely anti-capitalist. We can argue about if it's more Marxist or mercantilism or Stalinist or whatever we want to say. But it's not libertarian. And
no, it's not a free market.
So you asked for like some specific examples. I think one of the ones that you pointed out to me, well, I pointed out to you, and you said this is just like the first term. And so I went back and looked this up. Was how the tariffs were supposed to protect farmers, but it didn't work the first term either. And it's even worse now. But if you think about when we did kind of tariffs light in Trump's first term, and we ended up having to fund a $23 billion bailout for those tariffs because of the loss of jobs, the loss of product, the loss of income.
Now, in the form of subsidies, to be fair, it was in the form of subsidies that had to be increased. I think it was the soybean farmers, if I'm not mistaken, the first time around in Trump 2016.
Yeah, it's one of those that it's one of the most heavily subsidized things that we fund is the another thing that I could go all libertarian about, but that'll be a different episode for the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that's one of the things we most heavily subsidize. And so our economy relies a lot on that because we pump the most money into it. And so when you have these tariffs, when all of a sudden it makes the equipment harder to get, the steel harder to get, the automation harder to do, that this actually makes things a lot worse. So we have just a few numbers. Obviously, these are still fairly new. They're still very in flux. You know, Trump announced he was going to do them and then announced the 90-day pause. Some places are going to be like, well, when the pause ends in 90 days, I need someplace else to go. Some places are just hoping that it won't be like that and that he'll change his mind forever. And so they're continuing business as usual. We're not sure. But for now, California, for example, alone, just that state is on pace to lose $6 billion annually from their agricultural industry. And like that's just California, right? Like, and this is going off all across all the United States. Now, that's already a fourth of the number that we had to bail out last time. And so that is just projected this year just for one state. So making that the whole country, you look at the states that have been hit the hardest by this, especially Wisconsin and Michigan, a lot of their farmland. You look at the agricultures in Florida, the East Coast especially, and you just see the ways that they've had to shrink because of all this. Now, the idea was that they were supposed to expand, but it doesn't work that way because there's more that goes into farming than just simply putting seeds in dirt. And because we are such a global – I mean, you can't make a pencil without a global economy, right, as Milton Friedman liked to show us all, right? You can't make the pencil without a global economy. Similarly, you're not going to make cabbage the same way without a global economy. It's just not going to work that way. And so all this protecting that we think we're doing for these farmers are devastating this industry. And so I was just amazed to see that being true this time around, but even more so that this is one of the industries hit the hardest, not quite the industry hit the hardest. I'll talk about that in a minute. But the idea that this was supposed to be the reason for it, right? American farmers, blue collar workers, the people with their hands in the dirt who are just working for us, you know, and they're actually suffering among the worst because of these tariffs and the way that they're being introduced. Not only are they suffering, it's twofold. Not only are they lacking the things that would help them, the equipment and everything like that I cited, plus the labor, right? Let's be honest, a lot of illegals there, you know, but also nobody wants to buy from us anymore, right? That's all shrinking down because these reciprocal tariffs. And so it's like, okay, well, we don't want to do business with the United States anymore. So all of a sudden, we were subsidizing all those soybeans. People are like, you know what? Soybeans, not that hard to grow. I'm going to go ahead and get it from Vietnam instead. Wheat, I'm going to go get that from Ukraine instead. All this other stuff that you guys would used to turn to for it, we're going to get it from somewhere else. And so now we've reduced our market into only selling to Americans. And that's a shame. It's good for communism, I guess, but it's really bad for Americans that want to participate where we not only make a lot, enough to support all Americans, but enough to sell overseas. And so it's just, to me, the fact that that industry is so devastated is really eye-opening to me.
And it's also that, to your point, it eliminates competition. Because a lot of this pushback that I hear, it's like Canadian bacon, buy American bacon. Australian beef, buy American beef. You know, it's always like buy American, and again, it's that very nationalistic, very jingoistic response that is so infuriating, because that type of response tells me everything that you're either a liar or an idiot. There is no other option in between there, right? I would like to think that you're a liar instead of an idiot if you're in a position where you're making these decisions, right? As horrible as that sounds. So, you know, we've always said, what makes capitalism so great? That sort of like creative destruction, right? That the old has to give way to the new. You don't maintain, you know, a capitalism and a free market. It decides which industries need to survive. It decides when the old gets replaced by the new. You're constantly guaranteeing yourself a future economy, because you're not stuck in some government chosen. Now, that's where I agree with you. It's very similar to Marxism, because you have in Russia, you had the Politburo, who said this part of Russia starves this winter because we can't afford, we can't share enough to feed them. And, you know, the famous thing of Stalin going up to the map, circling a part of Russia and saying no food for them so everybody else can eat. And people literally starving to death because they could not, you know, get the food to them. Capitalism solves that for you. Not that I'm saying that it solves poverty, but the biggest destroyer of poverty in terms of economic systems is full capitalism, free enterprise, free markets, because the market allocates to where the resources need to go. And the other thing that it highlights is the political nature of this, right? Why are certain industries exempt from Trump's tariffs, rather? Right? Hey, certain semiconductors are exempt, but not others. Certain electronics are exempt, but not others. Right. American cars are, but only if they're 85% in this country. If they get less than 85% of their parts or whatever sourced locally, then they get hit with a tariff at different scales. We already showed that his formula doesn't work, so they're not reciprocal tariffs, because it's not like you put a 10% on us, we'll put a 10% on you. What they are doing is putting enough of a tariff on a country that we have a deficit with, so that the result would be a trade barrier that prevents them from coming into our market and forces us to either consume more of something at an inefficient price, or that, you know, we just eliminate that market and just buy it from ourselves, right? So the point being is that this becomes not an economics exercise, but a political one. And that is the real disgusting part of this, right? Because everything that you could say is out the window. There is no good economics out of this. I don't think there's anyone that would argue that. I think it's just a political issue. And that, Hody, I think speaks to a lot of what's going on here. I'm sorry, I just got distracted. Oh God, my mouth isn't working today. So one of our folks, Phil Rain from Via X, says, "Look at this fine gentleman." Which fine gentleman, me or Hody, or both of us, Phil? I'm not sure which one you're referring to. Probably Hody, because he's got the tie on. I'm going open collar, but we're both doing okay. Thanks, Phil, our friend Philip Rain there from the LP Alliance, Hody. Hopefully, we've got some of our friends in the LP Alliance checking us out. Okay,
friend now, of the show, we've seen
friend
Phil
of the
before.
Show. Yeah,
I mean, I'll take it where you're going with this, and I appreciate you saying they're not reciprocal tariffs. That's very important. That Trump based these on the deficits and not tariffs, the numbers that he came up with. So the idea is there's some countries who aren't tariffing us, as you noted, like Australia, that all of a sudden they are getting slapped with a tariff just because we were buying more stuff from them than they were buying from us. As you mentioned with Home Depot, like that's stupid, right? We're not.
Yeah.
I'm not slapping Home Depot with, oh yeah, Home Depot, now anything you want to give me, I'm going to make you pay 10% more from it. Or it's like that's a tax against us, right? This is a foolish thing to do, right? Like it's a foolish thing to do. And there's a real consequence here, and this is getting into some other notes that we had about this, that starting actually today, the amount of the containers. So this is actually the hardest hit industry by the tariffs is retail, specifically the containers, container retail. It's hard to measure that, but that's, you know, that's international shipping for you. That's how we measure it, right? As shipping containers. So you just think this is electronics, TVs, books, apparel.
Toys, plastics, yeah. Game boards, yeah. Things like that, yeah.
Right. And I don't want to make it all sound – unfortunately, a lot of people want to attribute that. In fact, Donald Trump was like, oh, no, you're going to have less toys, right? Maybe instead of 30 toys, you can only have 2, and they're going to cost a little bit more. Oh, no, right? Like, you went full Bernie Sanders with that one. Right. But the thing is, it's like, okay, but this is also cell phones. This is also clothing. Right, is shipped in containers. This is also basic food products. I mean, this is really tough. And starting today and going through this next month here, our containers are scheduled to be 30% more empty than they were before. This is disastrous. In fact, there was
I'm sorry, Hoda, just to be clear, you mean the ones we're exporting or the ones we're importing are 30% lighter?
The ones that are coming here.
We're importing 30% less. Okay.
We're taking in 30% less. So, and the reason is pretty simple, because a lot of people were like, well, if you pay for the tariffs, as you say, then why would people ship elsewhere if you're going to pay the price for the tariffs? Well, simply because companies are going to look at the price that they would have to absorb, and just be like, I guess I'll just do with less, or I guess I'll just find it elsewhere, you know, or I'll find it from a place that's not going to hit me with a tariff as hard.
So I can't afford as many of these containers as I did before.
Right. Like, there's just going to be a shortage.
You're absolutely right. And when you think of it on a very practical level, a $100 container that you got from China would now cost you $240 if you're an U.S. importer. See, and that, I think a lot of people may not appreciate this. When President Trump says, we're bringing in so much money from my beautiful tariffs, I'm even thinking of getting rid of the income tax because of these beautiful tariffs. Just, we could run this country the way we did in 1894 with Teddy Roosevelt, blah, 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 blah. Right. Again, going back to the 17th, 18th, and 19th century for this to work, right? But here's two things. First of all, forget about it. The order of magnitude in income between tariffs, even at 150%, 200%, 500%, literally will not equal the order of magnitude that you get from the income tax. The income tax we talk about in trillions, tariffs, even at outrageous rates, is like we're talking in billions, right? So orders of magnitude difference. But that... Again, leave that math aside. But the problem is the money that we have collected from tariffs, people seem to think, oh, man, we just kicked the Chinese in the nuts or something. No. Americans paid those tariffs. An American importer paid those tariffs. Trust me, folks, there's nobody from Scott Bessent's office or Lutnick's office standing in a port in Singapore with a cop uniform on going, you can't load this stuff until you pay the tariff, Mr. Chinese exporter. It doesn't work that way. The Chinese load up their boats, their ships, and they send them over here. When the stuff arrives in California or Alaska or wherever, when they get unloaded, that's when the duty is collected. And the person who pays it is the American importer. So when someone says, hey, first of all, forget the income tax. Why would you be happy over that? You wouldn't get enough. And B, it's still a tax, right? You have the tax. It's an American paying that tax. It's just that right now, it's not a favored political class. And again, tying back to the political nature of these tariffs, right? Trump gets to decide who's exempt. Trump gets to decide who pays this tax, which is Americans. Now, he'll say the Chinese will eat it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But why would they have to? Why would they have to? So again, political nature of this is a lot of where this is derived from. Hody, yeah. We had a lot of stuff. Let me just shape it up a little bit. I apologize for talking too much, but I want to throw it out here. Another sort of example of how this is political, right? And it was funny because Wednesday morning, which is a little inside baseball for the folks, when we tape, Mike Termott and I will tape Liberty Lens on Wednesday afternoons, typically. So by Tuesday night, you know, the notes are set. We've exchanged our ideas and bullet points and stuff. Wednesday morning, around 9 in the morning, I get a text from Mike, and he's like, John, turn on the TV. Caroline and Scott Bessin are at the podium. You got to see this. And I tune in. It was the whole Amazon kerfuffle. Now, here's how you know it's all political, right? There was, and I'm not sure if this was a made-up Trump administration quote leak or if that actually was somebody who leaked it from within Amazon to the administration. I don't know which side to believe. But in either case, it got to the White House's attention that Amazon was planning to follow in the footsteps of Temu. Temu is another online retailer that ships a lot of stuff from China. So what Temu started doing was, this thing costs $59. If you live in the U.S. and you want this item that costs $59, your tariff cost that we're passing on to you is whatever it was, $80, $90, whatever it was, right? And your new total, instead of being 59, will be 120, 130, whatever that final number was. That really brings home the effect of the tariff. So Amazon was considering the same thing, because Amazon is saying, like, well, we don't plan on eating this cost, right? We're here to make a profit. We have a fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders to maximize profit. So we're not going to pay for the president's policies. We're going to pass that cost on to the consumer. But just so the consumer knows, this is not us being greedy. Here's the breakout. They were considering doing the same thing as Temu. Well, old Caroline gets on there and goes, this is a hostile and political move on the part of Amazon. Trump reportedly got on the phone, called up Bezos, screamed at him a little bit. Bezos said the better part of valor, blah, blah, blah. He retreated from it, saying we never planned on doing it. It was discussed. It was considered, but we never went forward with it, blah, blah, blah. And here you have yet another political example where the White House is deciding how a private business gets to run its business. Because I'll be honest with you, when the conservatives, when MAGA correctly was against minimum wage laws and increasing the minimum wage in a lot of states, they supported restaurateurs who said, here's what your tab is, here's the extra fee to cover the new increase in federal minimum wage. And all these MAGA people, all these conservatives, all these Republicans were cheering that. Yep. Transparency.
So did tax too, right? So did tax.
Yeah, so did tax too in New York, right? Yeah. New York and Baltimore, I think, did that. You're absolutely right. And to that extent, I cheered on as well. It's transparency. Yep. We should know the direct economic effects of Washington policies in the marketplace, right? However, that transparency disappeared very quickly under the alleged intention of Amazon to say, this is how much tariffs are importing you. Not only did Trump say he hated it, it was hostile and political, he also said they should fire their economists. Why? They just noted math. If you're imposing a 145% tariff on this product, guess what? The price will go up accordingly, depending on the elasticity and the pass-through and all that, right? So there's a percentage of that that goes directly through to the consumer, right?
Yeah.
Why, then, is Trump upset at the transparency? We know why, Hody. Because then all the people who are blindly following him on this nonsense will feel it where? In their pockets, directly.
And they'll be mad at him instead of mad at Amazon, right? Which is the goal, is if people are able to see who is driving up these prices, instead of being like, gosh, Amazon's expensive nowadays, they'll be like, boy, I should have had this thing for $40. And I like the example you're using, because some of these things are going from like $40 to like $104. Like some of the tariffs are more than doubling the cost of the product, which is absurd. But, you know, I don't want, as an Amazon guy, I don't want to get blamed for this. I'm doing everything I can to keep the price down. Yeah. Trump's over here driving it up. I want eyes focused on him. As an anarchist, I'll put on my anarchist hat real quick.
Right, go ahead.
I think one of the quickest ways to get people to rebel against the government was if we had a breakdown on what our taxes paid for exactly on our receipts, we would all overthrow the government tomorrow. Right? The idea is that we look at these things and we just say, I'm sure it was for a good reason, right?
Like, yeah,
that's got to be what it is. But there is no chance that, like, we would sit down and be like, oh, this much is how I'm paying to blow up brown kids in the Middle East. Oh, okay, this much is how much I'm paying for these tariffs. Oh, okay, that's cool, right?
Yeah.
Like, and so I love this idea. I think we absolutely should see people we should absolutely break this down and be more transparent with the consumers. As you said, I'm glad you did too. I was absolutely with the conservatives when they were like, hey, here's the soda tax. Blame Governor Cuomo, right? Like, and I was like, yes, yeah, stick it to him, right? And so now that it's backfiring against the Republicans because they're doing Democrat things, I want to remember, reminder MAGA, they're doing tax increase Democrat things that they don't like it anymore. And like, it's just, it's the lack of consistency. I do want to say just, and I could tell, I know you got something else here, but just like the idea behind this, the actual effects of this, it's going to be really painful. When we talk about it, I believe 41% of retailers said that they're going to – that they're just going to have to find new business partners.
Yeah.
Like these are permanently fractured relationships. And they said even if the tariffs ended today, I think that they said it would take 3 to 5 years on average to repair the relationships that have been damaged. And that's if we just stopped the tariffs today.
Right.
41% of our retailers are like, I'm going to have to take – it's going to be years before I get this up. Listen. I was a restaurant manager. The bulk of my life was spent in restaurant management. And I can tell you when we get these little itty bitty taxes that nickel and dime you, we look at tomatoes. I decrease the cost. I decrease the quality. I look at my employees. I look at cutting hours. I look at cutting benefits. I look at everything and everything shrinks. I think everybody can think of a food product that they get that has shrunk because of just bad economic management during the inflationary period, right? And so, like, just think of this, but more and more and more. And all of a sudden, this cans of food that you remember being – I saw just the other day, 6 ounces, 6 ounces, 5.9 ounces, right? They changed the whole can size because they're just like, we got to give you less. We can't give you what we wanted to give you before. And this is, like – and it's more expensive. It's shrinking and it's more expensive.
Right. Shrinkflation, they call it. Shrinkflation,
right? Like, I mean, Chipotle kind of got blasted over this one. You know, it's just something where it's like, and you know, we had the ramekins, you know, where you get like a ramekin of sauce. I've gone from 3 ounce ramekins to 2 ounce ramekins to 1.5 ounce ramekins to like, hey, and now all of a sudden you want an extra sauce for those wings. We're going to charge you a full $1.25, right?
Right.
This is what it looks like all the time is all of a sudden these luxuries that we've enjoyed is literally the wealthiest country on earth. As you pointed out, gross domestic product. We have so much stuff in this country, right? That we shouldn't be nickel and dimed for all this anymore. That what we're doing is we're throwing all that away and it won't tank us immediately, but we're giving away what makes really Americans exceptional. If we are exceptional in any way, we're really tossing away that advantage with what we're doing here.
Yeah. And the reason you saw me jump in my seat a little bit, it was in sort of response to what you were saying, because two things that you said, and I'll even add it to what you just said. My libertarian hero, Milton Friedman, it's not Ron Paul for me. It's Uncle Milty, as I've said a lot of times. Two things about him. One, he said, he goes, bilateral free trade is the best. That's the desirable state. But even if it's unilateral, it's still desirable to tariffing each other. And he said he ascribed this quote to Reagan, Ronald Reagan, but I have a feeling it was actually Milton Friedman. He basically said, picture you're in a rowboat with you and your friend, and you're rowing together. And then halfway across the river, the other guy stands up, takes a gun, and shoots a hole in the bottom of the boat. He goes, now that's horrible, and he shouldn't have done that, and it means you have to work twice as hard to row ashore before the boat takes on too much water. He goes, however, as bad as that is, how much more stupid is it if you took out your gun and shot two more holes in the bottom of the boat? That's what
that'll show him.
That'll show him, exactly. That was one anecdote that I thought you might enjoy. And the second one is, and this is to his detriment, when he, near the end of his life, and he lived to be into his 90s, I think, they asked Milton Friedman in one of those Stanford University series, is there anything you regret in life? And he said, I have just one regret in life, he goes, and that's the withholding tax. Because a lot of people don't realize, because he is such a libertarian icon, It was Milton Friedman who devised the withholding tax in the United States. He was the one who recommended to the federal government, because he was at that time a young government employee and economist working for the government before he designed guidance systems. They asked him, what's the most effective way to collect the income tax? And Milton Friedman, being intelligent and efficient, as always, said, this is the most efficient way to collect the income tax. And almost on his deathbed, he said his only regret was that withholding tax. Because to your point, Hody, he said, in the old days, when you had to write a check at the end of the year, every April 15th, when you had to write a check for your total tax that you owed, it was sticker shock. Oh, my God, what? I got to give up a third or a quarter of my earnings? What are you, out of your mind? What am I getting for all this? That impact has been dulled by the withholding tax, because you don't even see that money. It's taken from you before it even hits your pocket. And he said, perhaps looking back wistfully, he said, my biggest regret in life is the withholding tax, and I am so sorry that I ever came up with that. Just goes to show you, sometimes the best of intentions, good intentions mean nothing. So you're right. I think if people still had to cut a check for their whole amount, like if you're a small business owner, they feel it, right? Because they got to give in estimated taxes and then they got to catch up at the end of the year. They feel it. And they're like, what am I paying for? Right? So when you look at it this way, you're saying, where are my taxes going? And what's the worst tax of all? Inflation. Inflation is another hidden tax. It is a tax on us, and it affects even though it's an even tax, right? Because it's a consumption tax. The worst part of it is it affects the most vulnerable among us, the poor, the middle class, because yeah, we all get dinged by the same percentage of an inflation rate. But to the people who have less, that means they have less for their basic needs, for their food, for their rent,
yeah,
for their child's education. So that they actually hurt the most. So and let me wrap this up.
I'm just going to interject because it directly adds to your point.
Yeah.
One of the numbers we were looking at while we were looking at the data is how black farmers have been overwhelmingly more affected than the rest of the farmers who have been affected. Now, this may sound like, oh, why do you got to bring race into it or something like that? But hear me out here. The issue isn't just that they're black. The issue is that they're normal people, right? Like the normal people farmers are the ones who are being affected. The ones who collect subsidies, who are going to be like, hey, you're kind of messing up like soybean production and whatnot like that, they're going to be fine. They're going to survive because they're just going to collect more subsidies. We bailed out the first ones, the $23 billion. We'll bail out this next one too. Who's not going to get the bailout? Where is it that we actually did cut the subsidies? Real down-to-earth, small farmers. Like the people grow. I mean, you look at what the government subsidizes. What don't they farm? What don't they subsidize? And these black farmers are largely the ones that are doing like beef, pork, chickens. These are the ones that are giving us like oranges, right? Because that's one of the things that's not subsidy. So anytime you see a Florida orange, the only reason that's not cotton is because they're working against their subsidies. They're like, no, I want to plant what actually grows best here. And it's these black farmers and these really like, I mean, just, you know, down to earth, you know, farmers. And these are the guys suffering the most. And so I just want to bolster your point, because when we say who's suffering, it really is the middle class and the poor. Like everybody else is going to get through this. I don't like that Trump gets away with being stupid as often as he does, because in truth, the people who sponsored his campaign are doing incredibly well, right? None of these foreign interests had any interest in his campaign, and none of these, you know, and that usually is a positive, right? We don't want foreign interests, right? Like, and so they might be like, yay, right? But this includes businesses, and this includes things like, you know, U.S. Steel's doing great. And like big, you know, U.S. farm agriculture is going to do fine. The agriculture industry is suffering, but the ones that are cutting, the ones that are really getting cut loose are the small poor ones. The ones who sponsored Trump campaign, they're growing. As you noted, we're spending more money than ever. We just cut all these subsidies and we're still spending more money than ever. Why? Because the money that we cut from all these poor black farmers, we're giving to the ones, I think, Cato has a good breakdown on this, but like over half the farms in the U.S. have the last name either Rockefeller or Turner.
So, oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, something like that, where it's like half of them. I mean, it's we're just giving them to the big agriculture guys, the big, you know, big government guys, the insiders, right. The cronies, right? And they're doing well. And so I don't like this idea that Trump must have been too stupid to foresee this coming, because this really is a matter of him seeing it coming. His people are very pleased with what he's done. This was detailed. Whether you believe the Project 2025 thing or not, those people made out like bandits, right? And all his sponsors have made out like bandits. They've been doing very well. And if the ones who are suffering, even though we can say, well, the whole economy is suffering, it's not true. It's these select cronies that are doing well. Everybody else is suffering. And that's the wolf that he's chosen to feed. This is Politics 101. It's just made nakedly obvious right now. Thank you for letting me talk there.
Appreciate that's okay. And the last thing I want to wrap up, which I'm sure you'll agree with me, is there was an effort spearheaded by Senator Rand Paul in the Senate to say, we must take back our constitutional responsibility, our constitutional authority. We are the ones who should be levying taxes. By the way, for purposes of that legislation in the Constitution, a tariff is a tax. Okay? It is under the authority of the Constitution, much like the ability to wage war is a constitutional power, is a congressional power, not an executive power. Trump constantly does this. If you've noticed, they're very proud of saying he signed over 140, 150 executive orders in his first 100 days. That's nothing to be proud of, especially when your party controls all of Congress. That is nothing to be proud of. You correctly crapped on that when it came to Biden, when it came to Obama. You should be better. The excuse of Obama did it, the excuse of Biden did it, is not an excuse for Trump to issue EO after EO after EO. You have a Republican Congress. You have a Republican Senate. Get it done. And they can't get it done, which is even more disturbing. And Hody, the fact that Trump is the one who decides what these tariff rates are is unconstitutional. We don't have an emergency. We already looked at it. We don't have an economic emergency in this country under any stretch of the imagination. Rand Paul tried to get Congress to do its job. The Senate, in a 49-49 tie, and here's someone who should be really ashamed of himself, because I think he understands the issue and is purposely deciding to ignore it, and that's J.D. Vance. The vice president broke the tie and rejected the legislation, however it was worded, to take the tariffing power away from the president and return it to Congress where it belongs. So J.D. Vance, in my opinion, I will not call him an idiot. I will not call him someone who doesn't understand this stuff. He understands this stuff. He's an intelligent man. Whatever else I may think of him, he doesn't come across to me as someone who doesn't know what's going on. He is being very, very political, and he's being very, very partisan to just be a loyalist either to the president or, to your point, to his Project 2025 overlords, whether you believe that or not. Because for someone who says, I love the Constitution, I love supporting the Constitution and defending the Constitution, if you were a Republican or a conservative who has always complained about the Congress not having its constitutional authority respected, you had the opportunity as the tie-breaking vote to restore some of that constitutional authority to your colleagues in Congress, and you turned it down on some faulty economic nonsense that you're selling the country. To me, that's inexcusable. That's something that should land you in one of Dante's circles of hell, in my opinion. I'm not sure which one, though.
Yeah, you
could tell me.
It's sure. No, there's a few that qualify here. Pride, greed.
Which bolga? Bolga. Is that what they're called in Italian? Bolga?
Which bolga?
The rings of hell?
Circle?
The
circles, yeah.
The rings of hell, yeah.
I regret to say I read Dante's Inferno, but in English. So I don't know. The thing about, and I share your outlook, because when you know somebody knows better, it cuts deeper than when they don't.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And so there's a book by J.D. Vance called Hillbilly Elegy, and it's a great book. If you are a left-wing or a right-wing person, you probably will like this book. Mm. And it's heartfelt. We know that J.D. Vance, the person, is better than J.D. Vance, the politician.
I would agree with you.
And so I think that's one of the unfortunate parts here is we know he's betraying his values, right? Like, I mean, stuff that he's spoken out specifically in Hillbilly Elegy. That J.D. Vance would hate now J.D. Vance. They're just quotes against him that you could use for days on end here. It's just become a different kind of monster. So we really need what we really need is some honesty and integrity from our politicians. This is what I always say. Quote that I have going around is when you elect a politician, you never get their policies. You always get their character, right? Everybody's got dreams when it comes to policy. Everybody's got lists and agendas and things that they say they're going to get done, things that they're going to try to get done. We almost never get that. What do we always get? We get their character, good or bad, right? Like if somebody's got good character, even if they can't get what they wanted done, they can at least get good things done, right? They can at least push things in the right direction.
Or do no harm. Do the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm.
The idea that power would make people better is illiterate, right? Like it's just from a political science standpoint is untrue, yeah. Right? When people get more power, they become less inclined to feel any type of reservation. Right. So there's this great study that notes that incumbent presidents always do worse during their second debates than they do during their firsts. Right. And this is because they are so used to people kissing their butts. Oh, what can we do for you? Oh, you're so great. You're so wonderful. And it's clear that as soon as they're back in a debate, when it's like, oh, somebody's actually cutting me off. There's a time limit. Oh, I'm not allowed to just say whatever, do whatever. Oh, there's a fact check here. They fail. And this definitely goes for Republican or Democrat. Right. Like you look at Trump's second debate, you look at Biden's second debate, you know, George W. Bush's second debate, any of them, right? You look at all of these second debates. and that's just the way it goes. It's just a revelation for that, what that does to your character. I don't even think I would be immune to it, frankly. You know, one of the reasons I don't want to seek political power is like, yeah, there's a temptation there. I genuinely think I'm a good person. I wouldn't do the things that Trump is doing, but it certainly would be at the detriment of my character to be every day confronted with these temptations that are always in front of your face. How easy would it be to just give in to all of them, you know? And this is what we see J.D. Vance and Donald Trump doing.
Or even, Hody, to your point, talking yourself into thinking that you're doing the right thing.
Yep.
Because you're listening to the sycophants around you. Listen, just to end it on this, because we're already running a little long, but I'll bring this up to your point and it reinforces it. The Kim Jong-un-like cabinet meetings that are being televised right now, I find them hilarious because I cannot in any way fathom that anybody takes those things seriously. I saw one guy get up and say, Mr. President, the country is grateful to you for saving millions of lives because you're getting rid of these fentanyl dealers. And I'm like, wait, what are you talking about? Everyone comes on, they give their little three-minute summary or whatever it is. They all kiss his ass for 3 minutes. He sits there and nods approvingly, you know, and then we're off. We'll do this again in a couple of weeks when he needs a poll boost or something. And that's something I come to expect from, like, dictator-led countries. Like, the whole thing where Kim Jong-un once announced that 1 + 1 = 3 and they all praised his divine intellect for letting him in on that. We're literally at that point, I think, with Donald Trump. Like, he's got all these people around him. Again, loyalists, not competency, loyalty, not competency in this administration. And you see them all just kissing his ass, and they're more than willing to do it as a humiliation ritual in front of the cameras in this thing. So to your point, if you're Trump and you actually believe this nonsense that they're feeding you, guess what? Maybe you think you are doing the right thing after all. All right, everyone. This has been a overly emotional type of free-for-all where, certainly on my part, Hody's kept it together. I've managed to, as my producer says, I went back to my Mediterranean roots. You know, I did a lot of talking with my hands, you know. When you're Greek or Italian, Hody, you tend to do this a lot. Straight from the Mediterranean. It must be part of the genetics. Yeah. Not even that smooth. You know, nothing like this. Just a lot of, you know. But anyway. All right, everyone. Hopefully you've enjoyed this episode of Free For All right here on Grumblings Media. Check us out, grumblingsmedia.com, where you'll find a lot of other great podcasts. You'll catch The Red, White, and Rude, which occasionally features Mr. Hody Johns talking about gaming. You could catch Fired Up if you're more of those yucky conservatives. Go catch William Del Pilar on Fired Up and his local version, Fired Up California, for people out. Is that the Golden State? Yes, it's the Golden State, California. Go check out those podcasts. We also have our sports guys, the Buzzer Beaters for basketball, the Blindside Blitz for football. Lots of great entertainment here at grumblingsmedia.com. You can also catch Liberty Lens with me and Mike Tremont. And if you're interested in some long-form interviews, catch my Big Questions with Big John series, typically focusing on some libertarian folks that you may not know that much about, occasionally just some other fun folks to talk to. All right, that ends tonight's pimping. Catch everyone next week for the Hoster and Big John. Peace, everyone.